Evil Woman was a top 10 hit single for Krull in late 1969. We're in the studio with two members of Krull circa 1980, Denny Johnson, David Wagner. How do you feel when you hear that song?
Like I was saying while I was playing, it really drags.
It sounds slow.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it was a good tune. I wrote half of it. Should be.
It had to be good.
But no, it's just that, it was a good tune for us and everything else. It was just that you get so used to the way we're doing it now, and I don't listen to this stuff very often, and then you hear it come back at you, and it's so much
it's updated now with new members.
Mm-hmm. How does it hit you emotionally, sort of? Do the words seem dated, or does the music seem dated, or what do you think of when you hear that song? What were you doing when that song came out, maybe?
Don't tell them that part.
What was I doing?
Starving to death.
No,
funny how history repeats itself.
I feel good about the song because the song is the one that got us someplace. You know, if it wouldn't have been for that song, well, I don't know, maybe there'd have been another one, but that was the one that put us up someplace where we got out and got around the country. No, I think right now the song is just as updated right now, the way we do it now. I would say that it's can fit in
right now, yeah.
Right now, just as well as it did 10 years ago.
It's not a dated nostalgia tune. You know, we updated the song a little bit, you know, just make it faster.
Mm-hmm. It's mainly the speed, plus, of course, we don't have the horns, which the original group never had the horns either. They were dubbed in after we recorded it. Although we do now, we use a sax solo. There's a sax solo in part of it.
Why don't you trace both of your histories back individually and kind of try and figure out where they converge? Just do the whole history of Krull and prior to even.
Well, the history of Krull came from it went back to in Joker's Wild days when that was I started up a group called Joker's Wild way back, and Denny was the original bass player for that group. Kink, who was the organist for Krull, was in the group, and me. And there was a group called Ravons back then, with Lonnie Knight, and Larry and Dick Wiegand, and Harry Niels. And we all got together, and Lonnie Knight went with Joker's Wild, and Pete Huber, and Denny Johnson, that made up them. And then we went to South 40 with Harry Niels, the Wiegand brothers, and myself and Kink Middlemiss. And
I think I'm still following you here.
Okay. And then we went still at South 40. Then we saw Harry Niels went to TC Atlantic, and we went to we had a drummer called
Molasses.
We called him Mike. What was Mike's last name? Forgive me, Mike.
Forgive us. That's okay.
Anyway. We had him, which he played drums on the first five tunes recorded on the first album. It was Evil Woman, and there was four others there. And then after we recorded and went to switch the name into Krull, then we picked up Denny Craswell, who was with...
But in between that, you picked up Pete Huber for a couple months.
Yeah, Pete Huber from Joker's Wild worked with us for, I don't know, a short time there while we were... That while we were looking for a drummer, and I don't know, but anyways, then once Krull was finally completely pieced together, we were together until 72.
About 3 years.
About three and a half years, yeah.
Intact.
Yeah.
So back in about 67, what made you both decide you wanted to get involved in music?
Dave was in a group called the Aardvarks before that.
The Aardvarks.
Group. Don't ask me where the hell that came from. Oops, I mean, where that came from. But anyway, that group broke up, and then he sat around. He wanted to put together a group. So he called me up one day, and he's, you know, we lived, like, right in the same neighborhood. We lived in a project up north Minneapolis. not your rich area. And he said that he wanted to put together a group, and it was him and... and he wanted me in the group, and then there was Gene Balaban, I think, on guitar, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And we were looking for a drummer, so we looked for a couple of weeks, and Dave ran into Pete Huber at some rock.
What was the name of the Grammys?
He was in a group called the Grammys with Jim Larkin, who's now Regional right. Warner Brothers, and right, was yeah. the KQ guy.
Right.
Yeah, he was the guitar player singer who ended up going with Stilroven, and well, everybody has their long little trees they go through. And anyway, the group evolved out of that. Joker's Wild did. Mm-hmm. And that was together probably about a year with us. Who am I missing in there? Oh, Kink. Kink was in a group called the Cavaliers, and I knew him because I was jamming with him trying to put together something, and that's where he came from.
So is there recorded evidence of any of these, the Cavaliers, the Aardvarks?
Oh, no. The Aardvark. Wait a minute.
They had a record.
Yeah,
a record.
We did a record.
Long Tall Texan or something?
No, we did a song called, Reminiscent by Buddy Holly. Huh. And the flip side of it was Josephine. Hello, Josephine. My
Chuck Berry.
Yeah, Chuck Berry. Yeah, that was the first single I ever did, and that was
65, was it?
64 or 65. 65, I think it must have been. Yeah.
How the time flies when you're confused, huh?
This is Nervous Breakdown. I'm Jimmy Nervous, and that was music from a decade ago. What's the difference between then and now, as far as playing, as far as the scene, or whatever?
Playing which one? That song, Slow Down?
Playing in general, I guess.
Things are a lot bigger now. Like, PA systems are so much more sophisticated and better. You can hear what you're doing. Catch me again, huh? It's just bigger, on a bigger level than it was back then. Back then you showed up, you could get all your equipment in one little station wagon and go play a job somewhere. Now it takes a 20-foot truck, takes four people to go ahead and set it up for you. You know, you have to hire a sound man, you have to hire a monitor runner, you have to hire like 2-3 stage crew. It's just costs a lot more now is what it does.
How about the sense of community? Has that changed at all? Especially among musicians. I remember, say 10 years ago, a real sense that there were a lot of bands interlocked that knew each other, that hung around together, and that's maybe somewhat more fragmented now. Is that what you find too, or not?
I don't know. I suppose that probably within the last 10 years that more people are more into themselves and what they're doing, what they're trying to create. It's no longer a sharing thing. Like, there used to be like the New City Opera House in Magoo's a long time ago.
Sure.
And bands used to just hang out there on off nights when they weren't playing. Where do people go now? Like Duffy's and... I don't know. I don't run into too many people anywhere anymore. I don't know a lot of musicians in other bands like it was back then. You knew you knew the Stilroven, you knew TC Atlantic, you knew the Ravons, Jokers, everybody, you know. We just all hung around and we were friends. Back when like Marsh threw his parties and stuff like this, the booking agencies, and Dave Anthony threw parties, and everybody got together and, it was a friend thing.
So do you think that kind of community still exists, maybe among
smaller movers
or among, you know.
I think it's smaller. There's more competition now. More people want to get out there.
Dave, you can talk to
him
now.
Yeah, well, like I say, I guess I get out and listen to several different groups when I can. But as far as hanging around with other musicians, knowing them, no, we're pretty much self-contained. I mean, it's just the guys in the group is we hang around with each other, but to know other musicians, a lot of other musicians and stuff, no, it's not like it used to be.
How about the audiences? Do they react differently? Do they demand different things from you now than they did 10 years ago?
Well, I think the audience is a little more sophisticated now. The audience knows the difference between good and bad, whereas I think 10 or 12 years ago, there wasn't the competition. I think people were a little looser back then, too. People were more apt to get involved with the group. get a little crazier at nights and stuff like that. There was a few crazier people around, I think, then than what there is now. Everybody's kind of a little mellower now, I think, than what they used to be.
Do you think that's mellowness, or do you think that's apathy, or do you think that's lack of drugs, or...
Well, I don't know.
You said it.
Do you think that is? I don't know. But yeah, you said it. No, I don't think it's that. I maybe they're just... everybody's grown up a little bit. I don't know.
Don't tell me none of no lies, woman, cause all you know I told. Don't tell me no alibis, sister, cause all you got I sold.
Don't try to lay no boogie-woogie on the king of rock and roll. Crow existed from 69 to 72. What were some of the crazy things that happened in those years? What kind of things do you remember when you look back on those times?
Fights, oh. Violence, sex parties.
Well, yeah, I tell you, a lot of things I remember from back then we wouldn't be able to talk about.
Only the good times, huh?
Yeah. No, we had... that was a... I don't know, that was a point... music was everything. Everything around you, everything was changing back then. It was that was a crazy time. I think the late '60s, early '70s, and in there,
the hippie weirdo area.
Yeah, there was a lot of crazy things happening back then, which, as far as I'm concerned, it was all to the good. You know, we needed it.
Well, there's still a lot of crazy things happening, but there's
sort of a different
climate surrounding them or something. Mm-hmm. John Lennon's assassination is pretty crazy.
Well, yeah, but that's crazy in a different sense. That's that kind of craziness we don't need.
Although, even in the, you know, in the '60s, there was Martin Luther King, there was John Kennedy. You know, craziness is eternal, maybe. But, for instance, I guess what I was thinking of was maybe some memorable gigs or some memorable people you ran into.
Tell about the time when you were playing, where was it, Washington, and you jumped off the stage after flushing down the bottle of booze and you couldn't get back on the stage because you went outside the gates.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I think you just told the story for him.
That was a crazy... Well, we were doing a festival. It was at the same time... that was when Woodstock... Woodstock was on the other side. And we were doing a festival out of Seattle, and it was a three-day thing, and I think it was the first festival, I'm sure it was the first festival we ever worked, and I take that back. We did Toronto Pop, which must have come before then, but anyhow, it was crazy. There was lots of groups, lots of people there, and everything was crazy backstage, and free beer, and free this and free that, and we got up on stage, and everybody was feeling pretty well, and I was probably feeling better than the rest of them, and we got to the end of a tune, and a guy handed up, it was like a 8 or 9 foot stage, and the guy handed up a bottle of wine. And because I'd mentioned something about I wanted a drink or something, I was thirsty. This guy hands up this bottle of wine, and I went to take a hit off of it. And all of a sudden, there was like 60,000 people there. And I don't know how many of them thousands started chanting, but they all started chanting, chug, chug, chug. Mm-hmm. You know, well, me, I'm not one to want to look bad in front of that many people. So I decided, why not? Yeah, I drank the bottle of wine. we went into the next tune, and we had this song. It was the last song. We had this thing where I did a audience participation thing and hand clapping and whatever. And I was really buzzed up by that time. And I jumped off the stage and down with the people, and I'm going through the people, clapping hands with them and this and that. And the band's up there jamming. Well, I got down on the stage, and I couldn't get... was too high for me to climb back up to get up on top. And I'm trying to figure out how to get back to the stage.
No, wait a minute. It was too high, or you were too high?
No, it was too high. No, it was like 8 or 9 feet up in the air, and I couldn't go up on the front of it. So I had to go clear out to the main gate and run around and get back
to the backstage again and get back up on the stage. Well, all of this took about 10 minutes. And the rest of the band's up there, you know.
Extended jam.
I won't say what they were calling me. But anyways, it was a little nuts. And I got up there then, and I did a thing with my mic stand. I went to cue the end of it, and the end of the song. And when I took my mic stand, I went to throw it out from me to cue the end of the song. Both feet went out at the same time, and I landed on my posterior. But they ended right at the same time I landed, so it worked out really nice. Everybody thought it was a planned show.
Yeah, half said what a show, and the other half said what a
joke. It was. We had a lot of crazy times with festivals and things back then, though.
How about Toronto Pop? That must have been a big one, too.
Well, Toronto Pop was the first one we did. And, in fact, Evil Woman hadn't... it was starting to get a push, but it hadn't done anything at that time. When we got to Toronto Pop, and we had drove like 36 hours or something to get there. Everybody piles out, and we're all tired and this and that. We walk in the dressing room, and Chuck Berry's in there, and... just all sorts of people. Blood, Sweat, and Tears was on the show, and I can't even remember who all was on that show. But and so we were really nervous about the whole thing and stuff. And we had a spot. We were supposed to do, I think, a half an hour on it. And it started raining. And the rain messed everybody's schedules up and this and that. And we got out there, and he says, okay, you got time to do three songs.